Welcome, everyone. Welcome back to Life in the Peloton. I'm Mitch Docker, and I've had a short break while the Giro d'Italia was on, but now we're back and ready to roll. I'm sitting here, of course, with my fellow co-host, Lionel Burney. Lionel, how you been, mate?
I'm good, thanks, Mitch. Yeah, did you enjoy the Giro watching on TV?
I did. I certainly did enjoy watching it as that weather rolled in. And that's one of the things that I do love as a pro. You absolutely hate it when you're out there, of course. But when you're at home, when it's good weather on TV, you're like, God damn it, what's going on? Once that rain rolls in, you're like, yes, horrible day. Can't wait to watch this stage.
Well, it's been a significant time for you as well, Mitch, because while the Giro was on, you confirmed that you're retiring at the end of the season, hanging up your wheels after a long career. I guess we'll talk about that and on the other side of your interview, but tell us, who is your guest on Life in the Peloton this week?
Yes, we can talk about that after the podcast. There's a bit to say about that. But before we get there, I've got a stellar podcast set up. I sat down with Sagabu Gramay, who you guys may know. He's from Tigray in Ethiopia, a fantastic guy. He rides on Mitchelton Scott. He's been in the Peloton for 10 years. He's got an amazing story and just so inspirational. He speaks so passionately, and that's why I love just chatting to him about it. This turned into an amazing podcast. So guys, without further ado, just sit back and really enjoy this one. Well, here we are, kicking back, Life in the Peloton, at my place. Now, I've got Sagabu Gramay. Now, I've just completely butchered it, and he wouldn't tell me how to pronounce his name correctly before I started the podcast. So, Sagabu, tell me how much I butchered that. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, and yeah. Just my name to pronounce, not only for you, actually, for so many people in the peloton. Sagabu Gebremariam Gramay. This is the slowest.
That was I can't so say. Good.
So, yeah, my friends call me Sagabu. So, or my wife called me Sagay. So, this word that exists in Ethiopia only. I don't think so. Here in Europe, so many people here. Sagabu, that's what they're calling me, so you can say Sagabu like what you say, so it's I can't understand.
Sagabu.
Sagabu, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Just forget it, man. it's that's only in Ethiopia happening, you know.
Well, if anyone doesn't know, he's from Tigray in Ethiopia, and you've got your own language there.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little sample of that? Something, can you say welcome to Life in the Peloton in your mother tongue?
In Tigrinya, which is also Eritrea speaks Tigrinya language. We have my region in Eritrea was same language. And Nkwa Dahan Mazahum Nap group. That's what we can say. Welcome. So, but like my name has, we have this kind of word in Tigrinya. So this kind of like pressing with our tongue and all, I don't know, like I cannot explain how it's going on with our tongue, how we created this voice, but that's the word most we use. So it's like hasha, it's like Arabic,
yeah.
Most of words they use, but we have this kind of a different also, like it's kind of this kind of word. So yeah, this is like looks like my language.
is it then hard? Do you speak English there? Is English a common language?
No.
So when did you learn English?
Oh, in cycling, bro.
Yeah, right. You speak so well.
Yeah.
We're doing a podcast in English right now. So yes, you speak well.
Let's say I think so, yeah.
So is the pronunciation, is the sound so different for you in English?
Yeah. Completely different, like what I say, like my name, you know. But yeah, when I come to cycling, many people ask me how you learn in English like this much in cycling, because I come 2010, my first time in South Africa, I went with the national team, zero English, bro, zero, like I don't know what's left and right.
My gosh. Just like hello, that, maybe.
Yeah. That's it. Then, yeah, a lot of effort I put to learn, and yeah, now I can understand, you know.
Mate, I want to cut straight to a point, and then we're going to go back and talk about your story. But I thought we'd start with last year's Vuelta a España, 2020. Let me set this up for everyone. I was there at that Vuelta and it was very late in the year. And everyone's got a story from last year. I'm almost sure of that. Last year was a big year for everyone in the world. Lots of jobs were lost, lots of hard times, COVID, I'm talking about the pandemic. By the time we got to the Vuelta a España, everyone, let's just talk about the cycling world now. In the cycling world, everyone was blown out. Everyone was over it. They said, oh, how can I do a Grand Tour now? It's so late in the year. I'm so over it. I'm so demotivated. Let's go. Let's do a Grand Tour. It's November. I was on that train as well, but we fought through and we got through it. I thought I was having all these hard times, and I started to learn a little bit about your story. And in your country, in Ethiopia, there's a civil war going on at the moment. And I didn't know too much about it. I didn't think much about it, being very ignorant about it. You were racing the Vuelta at that time. I'm talking about this internal struggle I had to finish a Grand Tour in November. Let's put that in perspective, because yeah. What were you going through in your head in that Grand Tour last year? And give us a little insight to what motivates you in these to get through these tough races.
Yeah, it was really a challenging time, let's put that way. And I found out that in the end of second week, stage 12, that everything was shut off, electricity and no phone and everything. So from that moment, I didn't speak with my family. And yeah, just when they did it, actually, luckily, in that moment in my head was like, okay, they're going to open it tomorrow. They're going to let it open tomorrow. Then every day I still was thinking about my family, and I didn't know what's happening inside, and you couldn't speak no one in that region. Everything was off, and beside also the race is happening there. So yeah, I'm a guy that I spoke a lot with myself if in that kind of situation, like even like how I grow up, there is so many bad up and down in my life, and in this bad moment I always speak with myself, well, okay, this is outside of your mental or outside of your thing, so let it be and just focus on what you have. So that's what also happened in my mind in Vuelta. Okay, this is racing happening and I will just keep racing. Even the team was behind me and they said to me, if you want to stop or do something, and like, just let us know. And no, I just want to keep racing. And even I was like, okay, focusing on my goal and try to go to the breakaway and just focusing to the detail, because that's the moment that I forget and less stress I have in my mind. Outside of when I am in the bus, always I go on my phone and try to call to my family, and there is still nothing. And there was a force of friends in Addis Ababa, which is outside of Tigray, which is I can call. And they were, yeah, I had some information what's happening, but they didn't know exactly what is inside happening. So yeah, from that moment, just 5 weeks, man, I didn't know about my family from that last week of Vuelta and the whole off season. It's just, I hear
nothing.
So it was really tough moment, really. So,
and that's a wife and two young daughters.
Yeah.
And you still haven't seen them two today, have you?
Yeah, I saw them after UAE.
Ah, you're after UAE.
Yeah, yeah. After 5 weeks, internet, the telephone was on that I can call. No, internet still off, actually. And I organized it to bring out my family from Tigray to the capital city. So like from that moment, after a month, they moved to Addis Ababa, and when they come there, and after UAE, I went there. So, but from I left because of COVID last year, I come July and I see them end of February, which is like in 7 months.
It's insane. And like, yeah, I bang on about how hard it is. Oh yeah, I'm an Australian, I'm over here, I don't get to see my extended family, but my family is here with me, my wife and my two kids. So in a small way, I can understand what you're talking about, because I could imagine going away from my family, even just a grand tour. I go away, I miss them so much. So,
I don't wish that for anybody to happen. This, like, really, I know what was happening in my mind and what was the time I passed through in that kind of moment. Man, it's just, there is no word sometimes to explain, but it's out of your control.
Yeah.
Like, at the end, the other thing was challenging for me is I finished Volta and my program was, okay, 3 weeks off and start training again. I couldn't start, like, I didn't know about my family and everything, and the year is coming, like, I need to keep also my job.
Yeah.
So, like, it's just so much going on in your head, and it's challenging time. And but, like, let's say I was really handling well, because in that moment I was doing a lot of meditation and all this stuff. Mm. It just helps me to through and to pass the time, and to, when I'm really under stress, like, it makes me so relaxed. And when it happened like that, every morning I did it, and which is, I always have better day mentally, you know.
Mm.
But still things going on, and you don't know about it, and so it's but yeah, it was great. No,
I love you. I love that perspective. It was out of my control, so I've just got to do the things that are in my control. Let's go back to the beginning now, and let's go before cycling happened, because this is, I think, a lot of people are interested in, and especially myself. Life back in Mekelle.
Yeah,
Tigray.
Yeah,
where you're from, the city, Ethiopia.
Yeah,
growing up there, a family of 12,
yeah,
2-bedroom house. Tell me what that's like. Like, tell me what your life is like as a young boy back there in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
Like, you know, help me understand that.
Actually, yeah, it's so good, I will say, at this moment, because like, when I look back, it helps me so much to handle bad or good things and to appreciate life. Mm-hmm. For sure. But like, when I grow up, I have 5 sisters, 4 brothers, and my father and my mother, and we have only 2 bedrooms, 2 houses, and I was sleeping with my 3 sisters in 1 bed. And yeah, that's how I grew up, and many family does actually, yeah, in Ethiopia back that time. And my father only works changing tires in a garage. He's the only person who works, and he makes the money for us to survive for 10 children. And my wife, my mother, she doesn't work also. And
yeah, she's got 12, she's got 10 kids to look after. So yeah, she's working
a lot.
She's working harder than your dad. Yeah,
in that kind of scenario, they are okay. They yeah, they get used to it, actually, and every family has. And man, it's, yeah, with 10 children, and it's something good about it. You have a lot of fun, but when you fight also, you hate it. That, yeah, family always, like, it just exploded a lot. And also you make a good time with the other one, you make bad moment the other side. It's a lot of fun. And now we are grown, everybody, and we always have a fun. But I'm now at this moment, when I look back everything, I appreciate my mother and my father, how they handled everything, and how they fighter they are. Like, because as a kid, I never think what they are doing, and how they are suffering for us to have food and to go to school. And to even, like, I was asking, I was really passionate with the sport. I wasn't good at the school. I would say I hated school, actually. Mm. At that moment, I love riding a bike, I love playing soccer, football. And my father was still helping me in that kind of condition. And yeah, it's just incredible, you know. And I'm so happy. But just everything's happened for good. Now, like, the strength as I have, everything, the mentality I have, that comes from there.
Those days, yeah.
Yeah, so you don't feel it as a kid, but it helps you a lot when you in this kind of moment and you go back. Actually, I wish for my kids that kind of challenge they will have as a kid I had. You know, it's like there's so many things happening
as a kid. And set you up later in life that when you come into other things, it's almost like it's not the first time you're facing it. You're ready for those hard challenges. And yeah. As you said before, kids aren't supposed to know those struggles that your parents have. That's not their problem. You know, they don't get that. You know, and only now, you as a father like me, you realize, and I'm sure it's exactly the same as you. It was when my first son was maybe even a month old, I just had this amazing appreciation for my parents.
Yeah.
It's true. I was like, oh my gosh, I get it now.
It's true.
It was only then. I just, all those times I made my parents worry, I was like, I was such an idiot. But it took me until I had my first son to actually get it.
Yeah.
And that's fine because I don't want them to stress either. Sure. And your parents never wanted you to stress.
Yeah. One thing I will tell you on this, I really appreciate my father. When I was 5 years old, since 5 years old, my father always took me to the garage. And everybody, my older brothers, they work so hard there. And also when you are 5, you have to go to the garage. Even you don't do, my father works changing tires. We call it this gomista. It's Italian word, gomista, which is changing tires, the tube, the cars, punctures, old cars. So it's like they work this on the bus station.
Mm-hmm.
Since 5 years old, I went there just to give or to see it. Like my father wanted us to, even we don't walk, we are too young to walk, but just to see there and to know what's happening there, and also to give, they ask you pinza or as a kid, what do you do? But at that moment, 5 up to 12, in that age, after the school, I always go there to the garage. And I hate it in that moment because my friends or the boys I have in the area, they play soccer and they play a lot of games after school. And me, I didn't have that kind of chance because I must go to the work, to the garage, which is, I hate it. I wanted to play that kind of. And my father said, no, after the school, you come here 2-3 hours and you go back. Yeah. And sometimes I found them, they are playing and I continue with them. Sometimes they go home and I go knock, I've come, let's play, you know, because I must go to the garage and to do these things. But now when I start in cycling, working hard or suffering is something easy.
Yeah.
When I come to cycling, one of the toughest sport for sure in the world, and for me is, man, if I feel tired and I suffer a lot, it makes me happy. I just handle it so well. I don't know why, but I think because the way how I grow up and everything happened in my life, yeah, my father was right. Actually, he wasn't saying me a word, or he wasn't saying me do this. He just takes me to the garage and I must do there. He was teaching me something within me,
second nature.
So working hard or doing something, it's just something easy, or riding a bike, for example. I start cycling just because of I love riding a bike. I never think that I'm gonna make money from it. But as a kid, I remember I stole money from my father's pocket to rent a bike, to ride a bike. So now I get paid to ride a bike. So it's that kind of life I have.
Yeah.
Working hard or something, it's not working hard. It's just enjoying, you know? That's what I mean. So as a kid, I was hated my father to take me to the garage, but now I appreciated him a lot because
he able to give you that perspective.
Yeah, without word. Just there, working hard, you get something. And that's how I grow up, and I never get tired of doing something. And also with this challenge, everything, I spoke with my teammates, this story, what's happening in the last November, somehow I made it, I handled it okay. But the truth is, how I grow up helps me a lot also to handle it, because when I speak with other guys, they feel bad with my story, and sometimes they try to cry, no, it's not that much. it's easy. Like, you know, yeah. It's not easy, but the way how I grow up, maybe it helps me to handle this kind of situation also, you know?
Yeah, just, exactly. It's it. Yeah. You're hardened. You know what it is to suffer, to... you can put things in perspective,
yeah.
You know? And to go back to your father, did all your brothers and sisters come down there as well, or he just chose you to come?
No, all my brothers also.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so my older brother also, he was cyclist, and he was also one of the really worker, and he still keep working, training, and he just loving moving, and he's tough. Like, all our family, actually, we are really workers, like, and that's because of our father, I guess. Mm. Actually, my father also was cyclist long time ago.
Yeah,
he's the guy who was started racing in Magala, bike racing. So it's like one of the first
guys.
So yeah, my older brother also, he was cycling. I grew up watching him, and I was racing with him before he retired also. And my sister, she was a runner. My older brother also, he was a runner. I am a cyclist. My youngest brother also cyclist. Just it's family sport, and we love working. You know, it's like it's tough family, I would say. It's not I'm appreciating my family, but it's just, that's the world.
They're just hard nuts. Because from what I understand, and this is not understand, from the outside perspective, the image I have of Ethiopia is just these hard endurance built athletes, people. And the three biggest sports there, from what I understand, is, well, in your city, is cycling, yeah, soccer, and running.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, it's true.
And is it like what we imagine, everyone's sort of just out there just playing sport in the streets, or is there quite a big culture? Because from what I understand too with your brother, is that he helped you get into the cycling scene, yeah, racing criteriums. But is there a club culture, or is it just a bit more free? Is it, you know, you're running here, or is it really set up like the European world, like even in Australia, where you go and you compete on the weekends, and in schools there's a big competition, there's clubs. How is the sport organized in your city in Tigray?
It's not like in Europe, but there is a race set at like around 40 to 30 races in my city. And when you want to start cycling, you need to start with normal bike, like mountain bike, let's say, but it's
just a town bike.
Yeah,
a town bike. Bike.
Yeah. Kind of like that bike. And there is a start point that you can participate without registering, or like in Europe you need to register and everything, or start pay, or like kind of just
license,
just free,
all that crap.
Just free open races, like in the morning, and you need, when you, for the starters, just to participate in the race, but there is no school races or like club in that kind of category. But there is club that also they give you road bike, and like only three clubs, so they look to you that when you start by individual, like come there to the race, and you get selected from that kind of category, and you make it to the club team. And my brother was cyclist at that moment, and he was helping me a lot of stuff, because he was one of the good riders also on that kind of level in Ethiopia. And he was also before me in UCI Eagle, actually, and also in South Africa for
was
some
he?
Months. Yeah, 2007 he was
so he actually had quite good bike gear when he came back. He had a road bike,
yeah,
good
from
quality
the team.
Yeah,
from the team,
from
the local team, yeah. Because the local team get everything for you, like the helmet, the shoes, and the clothing. Sometimes you get it in the shop, but it's so hard to get them, and also it's expensive. And but the helmet, the shoes, everything, it's impossible to get them, because we cannot afford them also, unless the team bought them. So the culture in Tigray is good for cycling, and they had this from the government. They look after that sport always. They put a budget, and they buy bike from Europe, and helmet, shoes, all this stuff, you know.
Is this because of your father? You said he was the first to start there.
No, if my father was out of the sport, but he was like racing long time ago, like let's say cycling in Tigray started around 40 years ago, so he was racing at that run around that.
So he was one of the first guys who really started.
Yeah,
it up.
Not the first, but like
the
cycling.
Beginning.
Cycling sport comes from Eritrea, and Eritrea get from Italy. Like Italy was Eritrea colonized by Italian, and Italian bring the sport to Eritrea, and Eritrea and Tigray also we were,
because they border each other. Yeah,
and also same language, we are was same area. So yeah, we got also from them. But when come to Mekele, after 2 or 3 years, that's my father was participating racing. Wow. In that, in Mekele, which is there is some people that before him was who really the first starters this sport in Mekele, but he was like the first 3-4 years just participating, and he was 4 years in the sport, and because he had family, he need to work also. So but he we have a lot of story about it. Just they do training, and they in the afternoon they work, you know, like because they have family, and they have this 15 kilo bike, and no changing air. It's
just like you said, they're hard men, and they built up, like you said, when you come here and there's all these different bikes and there's a million roads, you're just like, this is easy. I know you said easy, but it makes it nice.
Oh, sure.
Because tell me what was training like back home? There's not a whole lot of roads, is there?
No, no. Now, actually, we get like 5 different ways to go out of the city, which is good. But when I start cycling, there was only 2 ways. You choose in one way and you have to go back on the same way. And that's a road also that every car use it to go from city to city. So, but when I start cycling, that moment there was not so many cars, and there is people traveling actually in the morning. When I go back time, I don't know why people was doing that from 6 to 8 o'clock. All the cars goes to from bus station leave, and they went, and like after 8 o'clock it's like empty. Dead. So it's like if you have one car in 10-20 minutes, that's it, you know. So but we have to go, if you do 4 hours, you do two hours
going,
and 2 hours back, and the other side was actually I still have some laps to do, but I get used to it, to that kind of style, and sometimes also I do it in Girona. I love it, man. It's
out
like
and back.
Yeah, it's just I love it. Like in Ethiopia, when I in that moment when I go like back in 60k, like I feel like I'm at home, close to home. And in this kind of way also, sometimes I do it in Girona also, or in wherever I go. Just I kind of enjoy it. I spoke with my teammate a lot about it, and let's do it this way. And no. We're gonna do loop. Ah, you guys are crazy.
So it's at 2,000. Is it altitude? 2,400, is it?
Yeah, 2,000 up to 2,400. Yeah. It's like kind of in the climb, the mountain slope, the city. So it depends where you live. So, but from 2,000 to 2,400, and you can do training up to 3,000.
And tell me about the nutrition. And I think that's probably been a bit of a change for you, because in Ethiopia, when you were born in the 90s, they were just coming out of a big famine from the 80s. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And it was, I guess it's, you can tell me, it was a difficult times there for different sources of nutrition or different styles of food. What was it like growing up in terms of the types of food you were eating in comparison to now what you have over here? Is it something you like over here, or is it maybe not something you like the way you eat over here?
Yeah, some you like, some you don't. You know, like I say I don't, but like most of is good, but like we grow up, like we in Ethiopia, most of people eat injera. It's teff. I don't know if you guys you hear about it. It's you can Google
like
it.
Maize
it's,
or
yeah, it's like bread.
Okay,
but it's injera. It's one of really popular also around in Europe now, or outside of Ethiopia. There is so many Ethiopian restaurants, and you can maybe have a look. Anyway, it's good that so everybody eats this, and it's very cheap, and every family eats every single day, like this kind of
just
bread
solo.
Yeah, like it's bread. It's like Indian size, it's big size, and you use different kind of vegetables and beans on the top, and you eat by your hand. That's our culture. It's not by fork or it's just by your hand you eat it. And in the breakfast, I grew up only eating bread, I would say.
That same bread?
Yeah. No, it's different.
Oh, it's different
like
bread.
From wheat.
Oh, okay.
This bread I said is steph. It's called steph and injera. It's different kind of wet. And that's lunch and dinner. We used it it's like meat or this pasta or this kind of foods. It's like it's when I start sport, I would say.
Yeah,
actually,
right.
As a kid, it's not many. When you have, you need to eat like chicken or like sheep, just in special day, like Christmas or Easter, this kind of...
So mostly days. Vegetarian.
Yeah. It's because it's cheap and I know the rich people is different life they have, similar I would say from here, but like my family and poor family is like it's most of vegetarian and in general that's what we eat, and I still love it. I still, when I go back home, use same style of food and since also about reading about vegan and all this stuff, I just put it to my life. Actually, a long time ago, I was riding well and I didn't eat meat. The energy was there. And still now, I didn't. When I go to the race, I eat meats and all this stuff, but I have no motivation to eat meat at my house. I never cook. I always eat carbohydrate and different kind of protein maybe from other stuffs, but not meat because I didn't grow up that kind of food, so it's different. But most different, which is I like in Europe, is like the breakfast stuff, muesli and all this. Man, it's amazing.
What would you have for breakfast back home? Would you just, like when you say bread, what would you have just on the bread? Yeah, just plain bread.
It's when I was a kid, like my father can buy only 10 breads, 10 different breads, like maybe 20, 40 grams.
Yeah, okay.
And you need to have one because we are 10. So he calculated it and you have tea and one bread. You go school, but I look back, that was nothing. But at that moment, I never complained. Somehow,
that was all you knew.
Yeah. That's the only thing. So, my friends and the neighborhood and all this also they eat the same. So we don't think there is people breakfast eating more than that.
Yeah,
actually, in that kind of situation when I would go back. So, yeah, just one bread and you eat and you go school. That's it.
How was your, what sort of, where was your family in the economic sort of scale there? You said you're the wealthy people and then the poor people. Were you guys somewhere in the middle or were you, how
not
do you
really.
See?
It's like poor people for sure.
Okay.
Like if my father was not working, we couldn't survive for the next day. Mm. That was the situation. And luckily when my father's starting to retire, he's now 74 years old and like he was almost stopped the work that we start making money, like myself and my brother, and try to help the house and to the young kids. So my older brother starting to give money to my mother to help, then I come up also getting money, and it's, we were so lucky with that. But like just for today, that's what we were living. And man, it's like my dream was always to be like a rich man, which is like, man, if I have like 10,000 euro, I'm gonna have great life, kind of like that mentality. I have, because to have 1 euro per day was a lot with Ethiopian money in that kind of situation. My father was struggling, I know everything, and it's like, so just sometimes also like this kind of mentality, you grow up and you want something, you couldn't get it. Like my father bought me shoes and he said, this is for 1 year. That's it,
don't break it.
Then I play football a lot and I break it like quick, like immediately.
It's
like
1 month.
1 month or and I have to beg him to buy me, and 1 month maybe without shoes. I have to go to school, kind of like that I grow up. So I really appreciated that kind of life I pass, you know. It's like it's so good for me, and I saw that kind of life and I really appreciate life now, and I say, wow, what a life I have now. It's like it's incredible, really, because man, now I have a car to go around, but in that moment I was looking to have a shoes, you know. Which is
the perspective,
man. It's I'm so proud and happy that I pass that kind of challenging time, because if everything was normal and get whatever I want. As a kid, I will not have this kind of mentality now, for sure, 100%, because I saw so many kids that how they struggle in my age now because they grow up differently. But I, there is my friends also who grow up with me. They ended up with bad things, still in bad situation, you know. They participate in the thief, like stealing stuff, because as a kid you can, when you grow up as a poor community, it depends where you go. So cycling saved me actually to have this kind of personality in the right way to go. But the other kids that they didn't participate in sport, they have really different life, I would say, really bad.
Let's go now then to cycling and when things started to change for you. And what I could understand from doing a little bit of research for you, you spoke about those three clubs, and one of the clubs was the I've actually got it written down here.
Trans Ethiopia.
Yes, Trans Ethiopia team.
Yeah.
And they that team there was able to pay you a small wage.
Yes.
And that's where things, I guess, for you changed a bit.
Yeah.
This was like, wow, this cycling actually, I'm pretty good at it. You started to go really well.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of money involved. Is this where you started to get this idea of the Tour de France or professional? Or when did that idea sort of enter your head? Like, how were you exposed to the world of cycling outside of Ethiopia and outside of Eritrea? Like, the pro world, let's say that. Like, when were you exposed to that? Was it when you joined this team, when you started to feel this level?
No, after second year, I would say. Because my brother came to UCI, Eagle, but at that moment we know the only race is Tour de France. We never hear other races. We watch Tour de France on the TV, and that's we always waiting for, like for the year. And then my brother was coming to UCI, and he back to Ethiopia, and he was racing with me, and he was telling us different stories, and he was telling me, I remember there was some guys make it to the professional, to the Tour de France teams from that center. Then I start to dream to go to this center and to do more. Like, I had so many interviews, and some journalists still ask me, how you you had a dream that kind of that moment that he never knew what's happening, but because of my brother, he has come in the Eagle and he back, and he was telling us this, he was telling me this story. And I was saying to that TV station or whatever interview I had, because I was winning racing at the young ages also in that local races, and I was said, I want to go to UCI Center, and also I want to be in one of the team out there. Son,
listen up, everyone.
Yeah. It just makes me to create a dream. And also, my brother was saying to me, you can't do much better than me. Like, you doing this, you have this quality, and you can be a pro. And he was pushing me. He was behind me always. And I come to UCI Center, then I wanted to Tour de France. That's where I created the dream, 2011. At any cost, I wanted to Tour de France. But there was so many challenges that mentally that to make me to give up with everything, because I've been racing the whole time in Ethiopia with only 30 guys. Each team has 10 and like 30 guys in the peloton. And nice weather the whole my life. And I come to UCI Eagle, like, it's just something else. And just things are makes you sometimes to give up, you know. And like the first 2 weeks, I was like, oh, what is this? Like, it's not like I was participating in African races, 70, 80 riders, still big road and nice weather. But come to Europe was like completely different. But the good thing happened to me, I didn't give up. Like, I still had somehow hope and that I'm gonna make it, you know? So that's how.
What was it like that first? Like, okay, you spoke about the races and the roads, and I can imagine the racing was aggressive and the weather probably raining and cold. And what about the other culture shock of, like you said, let's just talk about the nutrition and then like living in the hotel with the other riders. And was this something that really appealed to you in the beginning? Was it a luxury, or was it something you didn't like? Were you like, I just like my normal culture back home. Did you get homesick in the beginning?
Yes or no, I would say, because I wanted so bad to be a pro in that moment. Like, I had a dream, and I always keep saying to myself and to my people, like, I want to have a team out there. So I knew it also, like, if I want to make a team or to be in one of the teams in Europe or in Conti team, I need to pay that kind of sacrifice. So I never look back, like, I miss my family, my friends, or I miss home, or is this bad weather. Yeah, there was challenges, but like,
I'm gonna do it.
Yeah,
I'm so determined. Yeah, this is awesome. I've got my ticket.
And what good thing happened to me is, like, in the second week when I come to Europe, in the first week I did under 23 national cup, I think it called Picardio, or I don't know, I'm not sure. Demar won, I remember. It was one day race in France, and there was also a second race in Holland, Zelelem.
Oh, yeah.
National Cup race. Yeah. I was doing with Mix, UCI Mix team, and it was so hard for me.
The worst race ever for you, ZLM.
Oh, man. It's so hard, and it's just like, I said, no way. This is not bike racing. It's like,
did this motivate you even more? Were you like, I can be better? I thought I was really good before, but yeah, now I've got to be so much better.
It's just so hard, I said, like, in that moment. And it's not, this is not cycling. There was from Eritrea, Natna El Brahana, in that moment, I was speaking to him, like, if it's all the way like this, man, no way. It's like, this is not bike racing. It's like, I didn't speak English. There is no one to speak. And yeah, there is someone also, yeah, there is also another good races for you. Yeah. It's just, there is no way. Like, just the race and yourself and the weather and the small roads, the punch, everything you talk about. And like, this is no way. Then after that 1 week, we had in Italy Toscani race, which is climb race, and I finished fifth GC in that national cup race. Then, okay, in the climb, I can do this. I had really good result, and like, man, when after that also I hear that the other thing makes me more motivated is behind me was Romain Bardet by 1 second. I remember him very well because my coach was saying to me, this guy, you don't have to go, like, you have to watch him because it's 1 second behind you. So to finish fifth, I need to look at him, and from that moment I know him, I knew him, who is this guy. Then when we come back, I hear a story that he signed with LGR.
Yeah,
wait a minute, like, I was,
I beat him.
Yeah, yeah. Then he gives me another motivation.
Yeah,
to,
it can happen.
Yeah, 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 to make it, like, dream big and to believe in my dream and I can do it. Then there is so many races, it's a lot of up and down, and but as from that moment, that the race changed my mind, like, I can do it. I can do it Tour de France, I can make it the team at any cost, like, let's do it. Then motivated me to work hard, and even like after 4 hours we come back to UCI, like, if you had lunch in that center, like, 1 hour, I always continue training to make it better than the others. Sometimes I destroy myself, but that kind of motivation I had from that moment. So yeah, I guess
Well, let's talk about the end of the UCI, and then you were given an opportunity to go to Doug Ryder's team, MTN Quebec. It was the very beginning of MTN. It was just a continental team then, and then it went to Pro Conti.
Yeah.
From what I can see from the results, I didn't really know you as a rider at that point. Things started to click. You had your opportunity in the pros. You had your first big result in the Langkawi Tour, top 10 in the GC. But you also won a stage in Taiwan, second in GC. How were things progressing for you at that point? You know, pro into a continental team, but then when you went to pro continental, were you just starting to get the hang of European racing and understanding how it worked, how it clicked? What were those first few years like?
Yeah, in that moment, like, after the first year, 2011, in UCI, I was looking to come back again for the second year. Then MTN Quebec gives me the opportunity to ride for Conti team, which is the UCI also agree. That's also I was looking, and right, I just took it the chance immediately without doubt. And there was people helping me, like JP Van Zyl, the director of African Cycling Center. He was there from the first moment. He's the guy. Also, he sent me to UCI from African Cycling Center, from Potchefstroom in South Africa. Then he was looking me after me, always he was saying me, I will put you a team, or like you need to go to UCI racing there, and maybe back to 2012 also, then we gonna look for your team. And that's also what I was dreaming of. And yeah, I was following him, what he say, and he was saying me, okay, MTN gives you the chance to ride, and wow, it's nice. And also was good salary for me, like I never expected that kind of salary to get, which is like, I don't know, it's like 500 euro around there. Yeah. That's the Conti team was paying. So it's like, it was, wow, it's amazing and changing, life changing with the money, and also chasing my dream, you know. Then from that moment, I ended up in good hand. Like there was people I found who can help me to improve my performance.
Get and more to, professional.
Yeah, to get more professional. Then that's also something come to me, the team in the 2013 become a Pro Conti, which is
handy.
Yeah. Just come on the way, you know,
to, yeah, stay to in the team when you're already up another level. Up, yeah,
on the other level, and like through Langkawi and Taiwan, yeah, I had a great result. But in that moment, I remember like when I go back, that age, 21, 20 years old, wow, just pedaling, you know, like so motivated, and just bike racing. I love the sport, and just I don't know like what's the future hold or what I'm gonna do, but I want to be a pro. In that moment I knew, and just keep racing. And the result I had, I wasn't sure it was good or not, like really, like because just riding a bike, you know.
Yeah.
then when I won Taiwan was also another step, just changing my life, I would say, in that moment. That just makes me okay, yeah, I can win. Like the feeling of winning, it gives you. Then that 2013 back to Europe, which is racing in this all Italian one day races, and all this race in with MTN Quebec was so hard, man. It's like, oh, it's just, you come from winning in Taiwan and you come to Europe, it's like
two different things. It's like coming, yeah, it's like coming from Ethiopia,
yeah,
to Europe. It's different. But
yeah,
tell me then now, because after MTN you got the opportunity to ride with Lamprey,
yeah,
Merida,
yeah,
and you got a chance in your second year there to achieve that goal, riding the Tour de France. You actually rode three Grand Tours. So in your first year you rode the Giro and the Vuelta.
On Vuelta.
And you were the first Ethiopian to ride a Grand Tour in that Giro.
Yeah.
You didn't just ride one tour, you rode two Grand Tours in your first year.
Yeah.
What was that like? And I'm nothing, not talking down on MTN, but it was definitely a big step up. It was in the World Tour, and everything went up a notch. You went to World Tour racing, you did two Grand Tours, and the following year you did the Tour de France. It's just like, for me, every year of your career almost, you're just taking bigger and bigger steps.
Yeah.
Is that how it felt in that big, in the early times?
Oh yeah, according the numbers, yeah, that's what they say. But like, just let's bring you back 2014. I had this bad moment I want to share, and also I want to thanks to the team MTN Quebec for sure on this kind of moment. They were really looking after me in that kind of in that year. And 2014, I had a crash, broken collarbone, and I was out of 2 months in the beginning. And I come back to the bike. And I was like training so hard to make it back, and I just destroyed myself. And I was not right, like with things how I was handling. I wasn't hearing my coach, because I start to think, I know this, like this is a training good for me. Like I was stupid actually. I look back,
where were you
2014 in Italy, in Lucca or in Ethiopia, like I was okay.
Between both.
Then at the end of the year, I didn't have a contract with MTN, which is also, I didn't have the result. In 2014 was like really bad year I had. It's most of the races I couldn't finish the races. So, but before that, like in that year, when I hear I had no contract for 2015, believe or not, somehow like in my mind, I was dreaming big. I know I had no contract for next year, but I start to think that one day I will do Tour de France, and it's still, like, man, I get more energy somehow. I don't know. I was like believing more that my dream will come true.
Wow.
That's from 2011 every morning I think is Tour de France to do. One day I want to do Tour de France. Every people I meet, I say them, don't forget this day. One day I will do Tour de France. And some people think, ah, yeah, it's good you have big dream, but it's Tour
good
de France.
Good on you, mate, yeah.
Some people say, ah, you're talking bullshit, you know, like, yeah. And, you know, it's like, but the biggest thing I was challenging is myself, not the people, because in that moment when I struggle in the small races, I said to myself, what are you talking, like, you're struggling here, how you can make it to Tour de France? You're talking bullshit. Like, I have this conversation with myself, and I start to ignore myself also. No, whatever you say, no, I will do it. Like, I'm that kind of guy also. I don't want to hear within me to say it's not possible.
Do you think by telling all those people as well, you also put that pressure back on yourself again that you couldn't give up? If you kept that goal to yourself, if you didn't make it, no one would have known. But the fact that you told everyone, yeah, it was like,
yeah,
I'm making it. And also now I'm going to look bad if I don't make it, because I've told everyone I'm making it.
Yeah. That's was in my mind stuck. Yeah. And even I had no contract. I don't know what I'm going to make it. And I said to myself, go back to Ethiopia, start cycling, come back again. I don't care. I will do it. Like,
wow.
That's what's my mind. And
what month was this? At the end of the year, was it?
At the end of the year, like
October.
End of September and October. I still was speaking, like, to give me a chance with the dog rider, I remember. I was like, really thanks to them also. I am here because of them, actually. If that was opportunity that they didn't give us.
Give you
was,
3 years already.
Yeah, yeah. It's like there was no way that kind of feeling to have, like, to dream big and to have the possibility and to push yourself more and to dream more, because that's, they make it to happen in me, and which is, I really appreciate and say to them, thank you always. Then Brent, I know him from Lampre, Brent Copeland. He was a guy also, he turned my life to this moment. He was Lampre in manager, and I meet
He's
him.
He's now the manager at Mitchelton.
Yeah.
We work again. For anyone else out there who didn't know we're talking about, this is Brent Copeland. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, in that moment, I said to him, like, he was speaking in one cafeteria near Luca, and I was sharing him my passion and my dream. And
how did you know him?
He was general manager in MTN Quebeca 2013.
Oh, okay.
So he knows me there, and I know him there, and the talent I have, he knows. But 2014, he understands something wrong with me.
Yeah,
like he's not. I'm not the guy who finished DNF because of
kind
of rider.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he knows me. 2013, I was winning and had good result and performing well, and that the dream I had also, he knows. And when we meet in Luca, he was staying there, and I said to him, at any team for free, all right, I just want to chase my dream. I will prove. And we had this conversation, and he was not in Lampre in that moment, but I think he had agreement to come back to Lampre. Then when he became a general manager in Lampre, then he gives me the opportunity for 2015. So it was like turning point for me. I am here because of him, actually. Really, if he wasn't give me that opportunity, the way that we were speaking about doing Giro and all these results will not come up.
Did you then, once you got that opportunity, I'm not saying you weren't motivated before, did this add another level of motivation? You thought, Brent's given me this opportunity, I don't want to let him down.
Yeah.
I want to go for my goal, but also now someone else believes in me, someone big. And now I'm in his team. It's time for me to actually prove that point.
Yeah. A lot of going on in my head at that moment, but it's, yeah, like you said, it's a lot of motivation. Still was like doing a lot of trainings and never get tired. It's like it's unbelievable. And 2015, I start in Tour Down Under, and like by 10 seconds outside of top 10, I finish 11 in Tour Down Under, which is one of the hardest race in January.
Definitely.
Yeah. Then after that, I go to African Champion. I won TT, which is, I was in good shape, which means like to win that TT, compared to Daniel Tekrehamont, he was also green age, and there was Rainy from Dimension Data there. It's a good TT biker, like
great riders, yeah. Strong as.
And
yeah.
I was a climber, and I just won the race, like wow, and yeah. qualified for Olympic. Just turned it like 2015 for me was like okay, started well. Then keep racing Treno and ended up Giro with Lampro. We won 4 stages and I did Olympic.
What was, just to go before that, what was your experience in your first 3-week race? Was it what you thought? And because this is your first time experiencing potentially what the Tour de France will feel like. I know it's not the Tour, but you'd never done anything like the Tour de France. Yeah. And you do a 3-week race, be like, oh, I don't know about the Tour de France. Were you thinking, oh yeah, this is, the Tour is going to be awesome?
Yeah, I mean, the Giro, like 3 weeks, it's everybody knows, like, for the first Grand Tour, it's challenging.
Yeah.
So it's mentally, more or less, I think, more than physically, it's mentally you crack, like, how that possible to go all the way to 3 weeks. Then my goal was to, when I start the race, is just to end up in Milan, like, to finish the race. It's nothing planned I had. On the way, I was helping the team, I was controlling, and some days in the breakaway, just it's normal racing, but I didn't have any goal. Like, the goal I had is just to finish the race, and I was 23 that year. But Giro gives me, I still remember what I post when I selected Giro on my Twitter account, my dream saying me, it's coming true. Like what I mean is, like, I'm still looking Tour de France. It's coming. It's not Giro. Giro was saying me
a nice step towards the Tour.
Yeah. Giro was saying me that your dream is closer.
Yeah.
That kind of post I remember and that gives me, okay, if I do Giro, then one step more. Tour is like, it's coming, you know, for me, you know. That's also, I have been waiting for so long, and that's the dream I had in my mind and in my head, and like, it's like, everywhere, like tour. That's it. You know, nothing else. So, yeah.
Well, let's talk about the Tour. The next year, you get the opportunity to ride the Tour.
Yeah.
How did that selection come about? And how did you prove to the team that you were ready for the Tour?
Yeah, like 2015, I did Giro and Vuelta. Which is also, I didn't feel it about it. I didn't know what was happening in the race for myself, but the team see I'm good in Grand Tour, especially on the third week. My recovery and everything was good. So they that's why also they give me a chance to do Volta. Then the next 2016, Brent knows about my dream and everything, where I race, and I share this dream always to everybody. And he just said to me, you know what, 2016, full focus for the Tour. Like,
wow.
We give you this race and show us. Done it. Okay,
that was
motivation.
All you needed. The extra motivation.
Okay, this year I'm gonna do Tour. Like, I have to make it to the selection for the Tour team. Then I had up to Dauphiné, all this race, like Catalonia, Romandy, all this.
How were you going?
Yeah, I was like, I was really committed to help the team and to be up there, whatever they wanted me. I was like, I asked someone, what's pro like, how I must do, and Robbie was helping me a lot, my agent, Robbie Hunter. You know what? Just listen what they say you and try to your best to complete or
exactly
to do
what they say.
Exactly what they say. And that's in my mind still at this moment. Whatever sport director said to me, it's a guy, will you do this? That's my goal for this day. Focus on that. If I have to go to the breakaway, I go. If I have to help someone, I help. If I stay with someone until the last climb,
I do
stay
it.
With him. Try my best. That's always I do. So in that kind of year or so, that's always in my head. And I am also good, like, something I don't know, I don't want to say or I don't want to try. Like, I need help always, someone to guide me, and I stuck with it. I listen carefully, and I try my best.
You need that goal.
Yeah. I try my best to do it, you know, and I trust a lot of people, like, whatever they say to me, oh yes, they have the experience, and I have to do it. And like I said, in 2014, teaches me a lot. I was a stupid guy, like, doing his way, and he thinks he know everything, and he was just going the wrong side. Then I found out it was not their mistake.
It was yours.
It was my mistake. So, like, From that moment, 2015, okay, let's follow what the people say you
the and advice
do, do the right thing. So yeah, 2016 and all this until now, I am kind of that rider, just listen whatever they say, they give me the goal and I'll do it. Like I am on it, try my best, you know.
What was that day like then when you knew after the Dauphiné or before the Dauphiné when they said, Scarbu, you're gonna go to the tour? You were just like, yes.
You know, like up to Dauphiné, I knew that my program is to do the tour. And sometimes also as a bike rider, like, you know, in our mind or the situation, who's the rider is going? I am better than him. Or like, you know, and you have the feeling. You have the feeling you will do it or not. So Dauphiné, I had really great year, like amazing race. Good performance. I was up there in the climb when they said me breakaway. I go breakaway. Like I had really good race. Then I feel it like it's coming. You know, it's like I will be in that selection. Then the news come and I was selected for the tour. It was like I was happy. I was celebrated at home with the family. I'm gonna do tour.
My dream in come Ethiopia.
Through. Yeah, in Ethiopia. Yeah, I was there for the national race. So it was good, but. The first, like even the day before the race was like same, like, okay, happy you are doing normal, tour and yeah. your dreams can come true. On the start line, on Saturday, I was crying. I don't know why.
What was the stage?
It was flat stage.
Just road stage.
Yeah. I remember in the
did anyone start, see you crying?
No, I was just emotional solo. And like, I until that moment, I had a dream, like, just chasing it every morning. Then on that day when I on the start line on the bus on before I was normal, I'm in the tour, you know, like but just before the start, like, you know, the atmosphere and everything, even in the presentation I had nothing feeling, but just on the start, like I become like zero dream, like a man without dream.
Wow.
Like here I am, I'm gonna start Tour de France. Fuck. It's like it's and on that year, of course, when Tour de France is the race everybody watching, but we are in Tour de France, I don't know if other riders, but my mentality was like always come to my end, my mind it's like the Paris, like Champs-Élysées, like everybody how they it, race and to make it. And in stage 10 I was crashed and
shit.
Broken my rib.
Oh no.
It was really bad crash. And I finished the race and I go in the my roommate was Luis Minches, and I said, man, it's I think I broke something here, like in my rib. So bad, really painful. And why you don't check it? No, I don't want to check
maybe they
it.
Stop me. Yeah,
yeah, maybe it's gonna be say it's broken, but it's like I'm gonna stop, or like I need to finish. It's like it's and the pain is there, like especially in the night I couldn't sleep, I couldn't breathe.
Stage or, 10
yeah and oh it's gosh. Like when I breathe deep I can feel it, like so much pain. And
the what doctor, did you say to the doctors?
No, I said to them I had pain, but like I didn't explain them well how much the pain. And I said to him in the night also, sometimes I feel it, and the doctor said let's check it. I said to him, no, I don't want to check it. And Dr. Polastri, he's still talking about this story to the team. And he said, man, let's check it and I don't show you to the result. And just let's check it. And this is in the stage 15. Fourth stage, I didn't do nothing because I wanted to make to Paris. And I had pain so bad. And I said to Luis always, man, I had pain. I think it's for sure it's broken, you know. Then they do the x-ray after the stage. They found out it's broken.
Completely broken.
But we are here, and it was good to check it up immediately, because from that moment they tried to give me spray, the painkiller. Then I was racing well.
So you'd already done it without painkiller for four stages. So when you got the painkiller, it was like, oh, this is easy now.
Oh man, I was talking every corner of every speed control solo, and I was angry. Like when it's like breaking, I can't feel it, or when it's like speed control, it's hurt a lot. And I say, fuck off, man! Like it's like so pain. And but when with I start with painkiller, it was quite okay, you know. So I wish I did it immediately after, but that's the tour, because my dream was, and like I just want to make it to Paris, and it was joy effort, I would say. Every crash, every suffering I had, everything
was worth it.
Oh man, it's like, it's just I was a guy who was out of a dream in that race, man. Like that was my dream, you know. So it's that kind of.
Tell me now, because this happens to me. This happened to me when I first turned professional. I had this, exactly what you said, this massive, massive pull, this dream, this goal to become professional. Once I'd achieved that goal and I became professional, I no longer set myself any more goals that year, that first year.
Yeah.
I sort of didn't think it was a problem. I just said, oh, I want to be professional. I want to make it. And I made it. That first year was so difficult, but I can say that in hindsight, because I didn't have any more goals. My goal was to become professional. Once I became professional, I just rolled along and just did my season. The problem was I didn't have any new goals, new things to motivate me, focus on, drive me. Tell me what happened to you after this first tour, because like this was the driving force for you for so long. When MTN didn't happen, when you went to Lamprey, this was this pulling thing that made you go and train harder than anyone else. Suddenly, it's done. You've achieved it. What happened the next year, the years after, until now? What has allowed you to keep focusing? How do you reset your goals? What's your new goals?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. That's also the key, because that I found out, if it's something you believe or you put it out there, which is like a dream you have, and you put it out there and you look that way, that your dream and yourself, and you try to go there, it comes to you, or you go there, somehow it works. Just you need to believe on your dream and on yourself that you can do it, which is on the way, somehow it happens. You reach your dream. That's how it teaches me what's Tour de France. From 2011 in UCI Center, young boy, and he had a dream. He wanted to Tour de France, which is mentally, it's so hard for him. Like, he grew up in Ethiopia. He comes from there. He don't know no one. Like, he's not from big family that he can even do something to help him to reach a dream or something kind of. He teaches me a lot in my life to dream big and to make it. So from that moment, I said to myself, you know what, I need to make a dream now. That's something impossible to myself to do it, not to someone else or whatever people believe, it's their mind. I don't want to put my finger if someone believe or not in my dream. It's within me, everything. So I said, you know what, I need to create a dream. And then 2-3 months, I was like, after the tour was Olympic, and like I still enjoying the tour I had doing, and the press in back home, and become famous, and it's all this stuff.
The tour honeymoon, kind of.
Right. I enjoyed, and was then end of 2016. My wife, actually, my biggest supporter, and always when I said, even I tried to crack in my dream, she always said to me, no, it's possible. God will help you. Always. She's really close to religion, and she believes so much in God, and she was just pushing me behind me always. No. You will do it. Then, like, when I spoke with her, what are we going to do? Like, what's the dream we can create? You know what? I want to win a stage in Tour de France one day. I really want to do this. Is this going to be like challenging? And I need to make it happen. Like, I need to do it. And yeah, I was talking with myself a lot. It's going to come. It's going to happen. So hard. Even like, hey man, like, it's hard to do it. Tour de France always, to be selected to come to the tour, it's a lot of going on as a pro, you know. Then finally, like I said, no. This is hard for me. It can challenge me mentally. I want to do it. Then since that, like, I want to win a stage in Tour de France. That's my dream, and I really believe 1,100 times that it's going to come. Because if you have a dream, you work for it, you believe in it, there is nothing like can stop you to happen. So it just, for example, the last 3 years, I couldn't even make it to tour with Mitchelton. And like, I still like chasing it. Like, that's the race I wanted. And one day I'm going to do it. I'm going to go some stage in the breakaway and it's going to happen. In my mind, I create this image always crossing the line because that's my dream. That's like out there. I put it and it's just from myself found out and to got there. So I still so motivated and I say this to so many people and I put it in my Twitter like bio. That's one day I want to do win Tour de France, but it's not what I say, it's what I believe.
Yeah.
So that's the energy between me and the dream. And of course, also outside of your dream, there is a teamwork, there is a team order, team kind of
structure. You got to make it happen with all those things.
You know, it's
things.
Like there is so much things to going on in the team, but that's the dream I have now. And I really believe that's going to come. And yeah, you will hear this back for sure when it's happened, because I will never give up until... like it must come, like it will come. I'm 100% sure, because that's the dream I have. And you know, my favorite book in the world is the Bible, and in the Bible my favorite thing it says, if you ask you will receive, believe you will have it. You know, it's like this kind of words, this kind of things, it just gives me so much motivation. Why not? Why not me? It's within me.
Yeah.
God is within us. And it just, that's what I believe. The energy, everything is within me. And it depends how I decide and how I look. And if I want it or not, you want it, yeah, pay. You need to sacrifice everything you, and you need to keep going and you need to make it happen at any cost. And I'm ready for that. It's like, that's why also, let's put in first, like, in this kind of challenge I had last month, last November, when I start my preparation without knowing my family, my dream also keeps me to do my job, because I need to keep my job going to reach my dream, and also extra motivation actually I found from this problem to save my family actually also, because I would never think to like for about my family. It's all about my dream and chasing my dream. But now I start to think also about my family, actually, my kids.
Because, to support them.
Yeah, not support them, but I'm thinking to bring them here and to have life here, which is also, that's extra motivation. Wow, I need to work more harder and make it happen to have, for the children to have good life in Europe. Otherwise, in Ethiopia, and you can have, like I said, it's like it's easy life and everything. It's just... with the money I had, is I can make it happen, you know. But that's also extra motivation I have found. Even it's really crazy to say from bad this kind of moment to have extra motivation, but it's like that's what I found also. It's like from this bad moment also, wow, I need to write also for my kids, because they don't have to struggle. Because my daughter both, they don't even know they are from Ethiopia or they are from Tigray or they are from America. They are kids, they want to play. They don't know nothing. So I don't want them to struggle, because I see I am from Tigray or they are from Tigray. They had this kind of challenge. So it's like I just want to keep them out that kind of mentality or kind of that history. No, nothing happened. Just you guys are okay. So I found extra motivation also to keep working, but also more than anything is my dream. Just I want to do it. I want to keep chasing it. And if I believe in it, I will do it. And it's not big deal, because somebody is doing it. Someone is winning Tour de France stage. Why not me?
Exactly. And like you said, so you've been professional now for 10 years. You're only 30 years old. How much longer are we going to see you in the peloton for before you achieve this dream and before you then create a new goal? What do you see as the length of your career now? It just sounds like for me you're like just starting. That's the motivation I hear, you know, like, and you stunted. Are, you know, like age 30, you're coming into those good years and, you know, there's so much still more to achieve. Tell me about, you're in Mitchelton now, you've been there the last 3 years and like you said, you haven't ridden the tour there yet.
Yeah.
You've ridden the tour for three times so far. The next goal for you is to be in the tour with Mitchelton and to get that stage.
Yeah.
Is that what the future looks like? What? How do you see the coming future in the peloton, in the pro world? Are you going to be around for a lot longer?
Oh, yeah, sure. man, like, what I believe is, in my dream, I don't want to put time.
Mm-hmm.
Because, which is, it's not really a dream. Because I can fail more, maybe. But I will never give up. That's in my mind. And I don't have a pressure also when it's going to come or when it's going to happen. I just follow the process and try my best and follow everything I have to pay, like I said to you. So it's something out. I put it out there and I try to go there or my dream will bring me there.
Mm.
But one day it will come true. That's what I believe. So I don't put time, but I'm so motivated because of that. And also I have different mentality. At the age, I believe when, like, so many runners in Ethiopia or in Kenya, I see when they get older, they become good. And I found motivation from that.
Mm.
You know what? Like, look, Kipchoge still have speed. This, like, the runners, Kenenisa, Haile Gebrselassie.
You don't need to put a time limit on it.
No way. Like, they still keep racing. And I am the guy also. I know, like, cycling and running is different. It's not the same sport. But the physical, I would say...
If you mentally want...
Yes.
Yeah.
You can do it, you know? So that kind of extra motivation I have. I am 30. I still... Wow, long way to go. I can't do it, you know? And it's not on other people's hand. It's on me.
Mm.
How much I work, how much I have to prove... And it's not easy actually to survive in pro peloton. We are talking about Tour de France winning and making Grand Tour. Man, it's just to hold your to keep your job in pro peloton is something another challenge. But the good thing in my mind is I don't see that kind of challenge. I see it the biggest picture, which is you get through on the way. The process also will help you because what I believe in dream is like it's not only you. Your dream also will help you, save you. That's what I believe because that's the Bible teach me. And that's, I believe, how God works. I have different kind of mentality on that. And I translate it to myself, which is, if I help to God, God will help me, which is dream is God. God is my dream. Like kind of, it's they are the same, you know. It's connected everything. Which is especially if you connected with your dream, that's one of you. If you fail, one of you can connect it, bring it out. That's how I believe. So I don't see failing or having out of contract because I believe in my dream. If your dream is true, it's going to come somehow. If you fail also will save you because when you go to bad way or bad moment or bad things happen, always comes to your mind is your dream because it's connected to you. If it's really like it's okay, takes you out. It's not you. It's your dream because you set it up there. And if you go to some bad moment or you get bad friends or you lose your way, from your way your dream can bring you back because
on the right path.
Yeah, because you had set it up before, and you were connected, but in that moment you try to lose and your dream come to your mind, you have a dream and you go back to your right way.
It's when you don't have that goal set and that dream is when you drift off on that path that
you can't stay away.
You know
what I mean? That kind of I see. So it's not powerful. It's all about helping each other and having a dream is like having hope.
Yeah.
And hope is good.
Mate. That's awesome. Let's leave it there for the minute. It's been great chatting to you. Really appreciate it, mate.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks for having me, and I really enjoy it. I never actually talking about this kind of stuff. Always we have talk this kind of stuff in the bus and with our teammates, but on podcasting here. I'm so happy. Just enjoyed so much, and thanks so much
for the awesome mate. There we have it, Sugavu Gramey. I'm really not pronouncing that correctly, but there it is. What an awesome pod. What a great guy. I hope you guys felt just as inspired as I did after hearing that. For me, I could relate to what he was saying about chasing that dream, setting those goals, and what you achieve on the way to pursuing that goal. He's still on that train now. He's on that pathway, and that's what I loved hearing about it. I left speaking with him so inspired, thinking, what are my goals? What direction am I going in? So it was really, really refreshing. Lionel, what did you take out of that?
Well, I've spoken to him a few times at races over the years, and obviously when you're talking to somebody outside the team bus, there isn't the time to go into such detail and depth, because you only really get a few minutes. And it's obviously an absolutely fascinating story, and just having the time to listen to the two of you unfold the story gradually, and it gave me a real sort of deep appreciation of how he's made it to the elite peloton. And a really fascinating story, and one that I just thoroughly enjoyed listening to. I mean, he's been in the peloton coming up for a decade now, hasn't he, and ridden the Tour de France, as I say, a few times, and you can tell his enthusiasm there, he's not done yet. And I just wondered whether, you know, any of that enthusiasm rubbed off on you, Mitch, and made you reconsider your recent decision.
It was funny when I was talking to him about, you know, how much longer do you think you'll go on? Because obviously I'm in that kind of mindset at the moment, and I've made that decision, and I'm looking forward to that next phase of my life away from professional racing. And what sort of, he threw me a bit of a curveball. I sort of thought, you know, he's 10 years along, maybe he's thinking about it. No way. It was just like, well, what are you talking about? I'm just starting. I'm just settling in. And he was so, he was motivated. And not that I wasn't motivated, but it was just, there's so much more I want to achieve in it. And he's still got this goal of winning a stage. And he's like, it's still so hard to achieve, but I'm going to find a way. And that was something I came out of it with. It wasn't like I went, oh, geez, I want to be back racing pro cycling, but I just love that energy that he had towards his goals and what he wants to do, and just that direction that he had. And it's like, you can really, whatever walks of life you're doing, whether it's cycling or working or whatever it is, you've got to set those mini goals and have that direction and have that gravitation pull towards whatever you're doing.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about your decision, Mitch, because you've taken the decision to bring the curtain down on your pro career at the end of the season. All being well, your final race will be Paris-Roubaix. I mean, a race that means an awful lot to you, of course. But talk me through how you came to this decision and decided to make it.
Yes, I've been thinking about that for a while. And I said this to someone the other day, other young pro, he was telling me, younger pro, not young, and he's like, yeah, I've had those thoughts as well after last year, after COVID. I said, look, in my experience, you'll have that thought probably about 10 times in your career. You know, you have a bad classic season. Well, typically for me, this is how it happened. I had a bad classic season early in my career, and I went, that's it, I'm done. You have a bad Grand Tour, that's it, I'm done with this sport. And then you probably get to, you know, closer to the end, and you get a bit more serious about those I'm done's. And I think last year was a big year for everyone. I sort of, having that time at home with the family, the level of sacrifice I needed to make to come back into the peloton at the end of last year, and the level of racing lifted, and it hasn't dropped. Or maybe, you know, maybe I am getting slower. I don't think so. With the data, the level of the peloton's getting faster, and I just realized, you know what? In order for me to keep going, to be in the peloton, to be competitive, I have to keep stepping it up. And with two kids on the way, I went, you know, I'm not willing to make that sacrifice. And I love riding my bike, but to be a professional cyclist, I think I'm just drifting away from that lifestyle. So that decision was at the end of last year. I gave myself another year to say, hey, maybe it was the COVID sort of talking there, this lockdown year. But those feelings were still there after I did Strade Bianche, after I did the opening weekend, great races, and I still could do my job. could do what I need to do to be a professional cyclist, but the real passion, the real edge just wasn't quite there. And I thought, well, you know what? It might be time to step away from the sport before I get to that point where you're really dreading going to races. And that was just it was a group decision with myself and the family, and made it early enough that we could really just enjoy the rest of the season.
So it's time to see what life has in store outside of the peloton, and we wait and see what the big wide world has in store for you, Mitch.
I'm very excited, yeah, like scared and excited, because it's something that I've known for so long, and you know, you do it second nature, and you know how to go a bit harder or a bit easier. That's just what you do. That's your job. Been, you know, cycling for almost 20 years now, and, you know, not professionally, obviously, but it's something that I've known, and to step away from it and do, it almost feels like you're retiring from your career, because, you know, ultimately you are starting fresh. But I am just thinking about it, giving myself a bit of time and seeing what opportunities arise, and then maybe pursuing them, or we'll see where the road takes me next year.
And Paris-Roubaix, of course, it's taking place on the day after your birthday, so I mean, it could be the perfect weekend.
I know. How good's that? I tell you, it was my decision, my official decision came after the Roubaix was cancelled. And then I went, you know what? What am I waiting for? You know, Roubaix was going to be a telling moment for me. And when I didn't get to do Roubaix in April, I went, okay, I'm going to call the team and say this is it. And I just thought, wow, to be able to finish on Roubaix at the end of the year, it's going to keep me inspired to the end of my last year. It's going to make me train as hard as I do every year for the classics right till October. And I'm going to have the hardest, most beautiful race to finish on. I'm romanticizing it now, but I can tell you right now, there's going to be some moments when I'm doing Roubaix at the end of the year where I'm like, this was a bad idea. But you know what? I'll deal with that at the time. And at this moment, it's just sounding pretty nice. But anyway, Life in the Peloton is back now for a couple of weeks. I've got another podcast coming up in a fortnight's time. Then we're around again for the Tour de France, believe it or not, that quick. We're going to have another little break while the Grand Tour is on, and then I'll be back again after the Tour de France. But that's a long way off. Hang in for 2 weeks' time. There'll be a Talking Luft over at Life in the Peloton next week if you want to hear it a little bit more from Sagabu. But guys, thanks again for tuning in. Love hearing your feedback. So I look forward to hearing from you. Cheers. You have been listening to Life in the Peloton. The producer of this episode was Will Jones. The music in this episode was composed by Pete Shelley. Thanks, mate.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.